All right, we are back on the record for the Colorado Ballot Title Setting Board. We're now starting our rehearings, and the first matter for rehearing is Title 2013-2014, number 82. And this was filed by Ms. Taylor. Is it Ms. Titus?
Yes, I'm okay. Ms. Titus. Elizabeth Titus on behalf of Ms. Ram Cordero and Scott Prestige, and also with me is Chantel Taylor, also on behalf of the opponents.
Do you want to just describe the general basis for your motion, and then we'll see if there's any questions?
Sure. There are three bases for our motion. First, we contend that the board lacked jurisdiction to set title because the final version of the initiative was not submitted for the review and comment process. We also contend that the initiative violates a single subject rule and that the title, as currently set, does not reflect the important aspects of the measure. If it makes sense, I'd like to first address the jurisdictional issue regarding the review and comment meeting, and then perhaps deal with that first and then move on to the other topics.
Sure, go ahead, Sarah.
The Colorado Constitution requires that all initiated constitutional amendments be submitted to the legislative offices for review and comment. The proponents made substantial changes to their original measure, so substantial, in fact, that the final text bears little resemblance to the original. Simply, the final measure submitted to the board of number 82 is a new measure. And because they did not submit this new measure to the legislative offices for review and comment, the board lacks jurisdiction to set title. The constitutional requirement for the review and comment process is found in Article 5, Section 1, Subsection 5 of the Constitution. The Supreme Court in Milliken v. Meyer, 979 P. 2nd, 1283, construed this provision and has held that a significantly amended measure, like number 82, must be submitted to legislative offices for review and comment. The court also reasoned that to allow such a measure to avoid the review and comment process frustrates the purpose of the constitutional requirement, which is to provide both the petitioners and the public of the potential impacts of the proposed measure. I'd like to direct your attention to the red line submitted by proponents. It's also attached to our motion for rehearing, and I have copies for the board if anyone needs one.
Okay. I think I have a copy of it.
Okay.
But can I ask you a quick question to make sure I understand the legal argument you're making?
Yes.
As I understand it, you're saying that any substantive changes, substantial changes to the measure mean it has to go back to review and comment, even if they were made in direct response to questions. Is that right?
Not exactly. If the substantive changes render the measure entirely new, then I would say yes, that they would need to go back for review and comment as required by the Constitution. I don't think that we can construe direct response so broadly to allow a measure, to allow proponents to draft what amounts to an entirely new measure that does not receive the benefit of the review and comment process. And I would also submit that not all of the changes that proponents made were made in direct response to comments by legislative counsel.
All right, well, those are two different arguments, it seems to me. The statute, and I understand some of the kind of the policy idea that you put forward in your motion, that if you alter it in such a fundamental way that it's a new measure, then that's a little bit strange, even if it is in direct response. On the other hand, what the statute says is substantial amendment, if any substantial amendment is made to the petition other than in direct response to comments, then you have to resubmit it, which to me makes it pretty clear that you can make substantial changes as long as they're in direct response. And so the second part of the argument is one thing. The first part, that it doesn't matter if they're in direct response, if they're so substantial, is to me not the way we've interpreted that part of the statute before.
I think you have to interpret the statute in light of the constitutional requirement. I mean, the Constitution trumps the statute, so to speak. So the Constitution requires that any new measure receive review and comment. Now, to the extent that the legislature has said, okay, well, if you're making substantial changes, those need to be construed within the constitutional requirement. And that that direct response and substantial changes, indirect response, cannot be construed so broadly as to allow an entirely new measure to avoid the review and comment process.
Okay, thank you.
And I think, you know, if you look particularly at the most substantial change here is the definition of oil and gas development. And this is a perfect example of why this measure needs review and comment. The definition is extremely broad, and it includes all physical or chemical processes or procedures used to explore for, extract, process, produce, store, or transport petroleum products, including natural gas and byproducts such as asphalt or waste. This definition goes so far beyond what the general public's understanding of oil and gas development includes, and could be construed to include a limitless number of industries like oil refining, gas processing, and public utilities, and also consumer products that are byproducts of petroleum or that are produced from petroleum, like plastics, paint, tires, and as the measure mentioned specifically, asphalt. The definition also has another sentence that states that retailers of petroleum product consumer goods are not developers. But this sentence only adds to the vagueness of the measure. Developer doesn't appear anywhere else in the measure, and that term implies that manufacturers, wholesalers, distributors of consumer products are developers, whatever that means in this measure. So I think this is a perfect example of such a substantial change that goes beyond that would be required by the Constitution to go through the review and comment process. I can also, I'd also like to direct your attention to the purpose and finding section. This section is entirely new, and the original talked about inalienable rights and protecting those inalienable rights. The new section totally abandons this rights-based approach and talks about protecting the public from the public's health, safety, welfare, property values, the precautionary principle, and other things. I've reviewed the review and comment memo, and I don't see how any of these changes were made in direct response to the comments of Legislative Council.
Any questions from the board?
I do have one question. Ms. Titus, in terms of the case authority that you rely on in your motion,
yes,
the fact situation in that case is different than this particular situation, isn't it?
Correct.
So we don't have this. This is the same measure, same number. I mean, my understanding of the case authority that you rely on was there was a title set for what's referred to as the April
right
initiative, and then there was a May initiative filed, which didn't go through review and comment. And that's not what's going on in this particular case with the initiative before us right now, correct?
That's correct.
So in terms of relying on that authority to say that this is a new measure and has to go through review and comment, it's not really analogous.
Well, it is analogous in some ways. And the Supreme Court hasn't spoke on this issue or construed the article of the Constitution that I refer to very often. So that's part of the reason for that case citation. But in that case, what had happened, and this is before the single subject rule was in place, the measure had, let's say, about 10 topics. And title was set on that measure. And then the same proponents went back and picked about 3 of those topics to include in the new measure. So unlike this situation, the language, actually, of the measure had been vetted by legislative offices, although it was just less language that was being submitted for review and comment. But the effect of the measure was very different. And the point is that the public, in either scenario, should be put on notice of the effects and potential impacts of the measure. So in that way, you know, we have the same issue in that in both situations, the changes are so substantial that it changes the impacts and the potential effects of the measure, and therefore the review and comment process is required.
Okay, and isn't it also true that part of the way that the public ascertains sort of what a measure does, proposes to do, is the fact that the proponents are required to file, when they file with Title Board, the original and amended version that shows all the changes made and the final version, so that, again, the public is apprised of any changes that they made between review and comment and Title Board?
Fair enough. They're aware of the changes, but they're not, that doesn't go through the review and comment process, and the public is not put on notice, nor the proponents of the potential effects of those changes. And that is the purpose, according to the Supreme Court, of the constitutional requirement for review and comment, that the potential impacts of the measure are vetted by legislative counsel, and the public and the proponents have a chance to hear what those potential impacts are and understand how this measure would be put into place, essentially, if it were to become law.
And isn't also a purpose of the review and comment process is to assist the proponents in drafting their measure so that it...
Yes, exactly. So with regard to this definition of oil and gas development, that would have been a great opportunity for the proponents to have the benefit of the legislative offices to point out, perhaps, that it's very broad, all the implications, and the fact that the last sentence talking about developers, specifying what is not developers, only adds to the vagueness of the measure because developers isn't otherwise mentioned in the measure.
But isn't that also a reason why the process allows proponents to amend their measure after review and comment and file that amended version with the Title Board so that changes that are in direct response to that input from the legislative staff, they can make those changes without having to start over?
Sure, but I think the purpose is to be more akin to something like this. There was a question in the review and comment session that said, essentially, do the proponents intend to add a definition of oil and gas development? And the proponent said, yes, we do. And that was the end of the discussion. If the proponents had submitted this definition of oil and gas development to the legislative council, they might have said, have you considered how broad this proposal is, that it may sweep, that it may include industries and products that go beyond the general public's understanding of what oil and gas development means. Are you aware that the term developers isn't used anywhere else in your measure? So if they had amended their definition in direct response to a more specific comment, then I think the purpose of review and comment is served. But to have a general question that says, do you intend to add a definition? Yes, we do. And when the definition that gets added expands the scope of the measure so substantially, that the Constitution requires that go through review and comment.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Y'all want to do this one separately, or you want to just take all the comments at once?
I think it probably makes sense to do it separately.
Okay. How about, let's hear from the proponent then.
Thank you for giving me this opportunity to speak. My name is Kate Tone. I'm the attorney on behalf of the proponents for Measure 82. My proponents are here today, and they have signed in with the notary. I know you have over 50 matters to hear today. I will try to be brief. Or I guess you're not going to hear them all today, but hopefully. The petitioners have brought us here on four issues. If you don't mind, I will address the final three issues, which I think can be addressed much more briefly.
Well, actually, we're just going to take up...
Oh, just the first one.
The
okay.
first one, and then we'll just move through them.
Fine. I have a PowerPoint presentation going through the changes to the amendment process. So I'd like to note that, just briefly, the Supreme Court has consistently held that both the constitutional and statutory provisions are to be liberally construed to facilitate this fundamental constitutional right of the people to propose initiatives. This was never intended to be a battle between the lawyers. This is a citizens' process. Okay. So the first issue cited by the petitioners is the issue of, quote, failure to submit to legislative counsel. The attorney has cited a single case to support her argument and has ignored an entire body of case law. She's misleading to the rules regarding direct responses and clarifications. Since we've already gone through that case, I won't repeat that. Even that single case that she does rely on admits that the proponents may choose to amend the initiative in light of the legislative council comments. The statute requires only that the original text of a proposed initiative be submitted for review and comment. There is no requirement for submission of an amended initiative after the original has been submitted. There are at least half a dozen cases that agree, and the court has never held differently. Resubmissions to the legislative council are not necessary if a change to an initiative satisfies either of two conditions: clarifications, which the Supreme Court has held are to be encouraged, or direct responses to legislative council questions. The legislative council hearing is an important part of the process and a constitutional requirement. It's a step we took seriously. Our original initiative was submitted February 21st. Our hearing was March 7th. Claiming that we skipped this step entirely is a battle with a straw man. The amendments to our initiative do not alter the meaning or intent of our initiative, which has always been to empower local governments to enact restrictions on oil and gas development without fear of state preemption. Unless there are objections, I will now walk through the amendments made to the initiative between the Legislative Council and submission to the Title Board with the questions highlighted. So, page one. Section 1A is in the purpose and findings section. 1A has four clauses now, and the first clause appeared originally in the initiative and discussed inalienable rights. The amended version no longer discusses inalienable rights. If you flip to the next page, you'll see that Legislative Council asked us several questions expressing confusion over the concept of inalienable rights, how they're determined and applied. In question two, they asked us what are those rights and where are they enumerated. In question 6G, they asked us about whether noise, unsightly facilities, or the right to live without risk from an environmental hazard, if those are inalienable rights. They wanted to know many times where those rights were enumerated. Next page. The phrase inalienable rights seemed to be ambiguous and confusing to the Legislative Council and would therefore invite litigation. In response to these concerns, we replaced the ambiguous inalienable rights with a specific, though not exclusive, list of local interests to be protected, including air quality, public health, safety, and welfare, property values, and the character of our communities. Not only is this in direct response to Legislative Council's confusion over the scope of potential inalienable rights, as expressed in at least two different questions, but this change constitutes a clarification. Colorado recognizes the inalienable rights of all people in Article 2, Section 3 of its Constitution and provides a non-exclusive list of such rights, including the right of enjoying and defending their lives and liberties, of acquiring and possessing and protecting property, and of seeking and obtaining their safety and happiness. This is in addition to other rights which have been found in case law and other sources. We believe that this list of local interests could have been defended as inalienable rights of the public. However, by enumerating a non-exclusive list of, quote, local interests that may be impacted by oil and gas development, we've provided additional guidance for the courts and have removed unnecessary ambiguity. I cite a case in re-ballot title 1999 to 2000, number 256, at 12 P3D 246, finding that petitioners could, quote, eliminate the language creating the ambiguities that directors pointed out, end quote, without the need for resubmission. The Legislative Council, in their four pages of substantive questions, expressed many questions about our meaning or intent. Therefore, our amendments are concentrated in 1A, purpose and findings, which is not substantive, but provides guidance to the courts as to the intent of the adopters. Section 1A has three new findings clauses, which were added in response to the questions of the Legislative Council. So, the second clause reads that the public has historically relied upon local governments to regulate certain local land uses and to minimize potential conflicts between industrial development and the interests of the local community. This clause was added in response, direct response, to questions 5 and 6 and their various subparts. Question 5 has three subparts, and it asks about the ability of local governments to enact regulations, particularly with regard to their potential interjurisdictional effects. Question 6 has 9 subparts and asks about the ability of local governments to enact regulations, particularly with regard to state law. The second clause clarifies and addresses these questions. Local governments have historically regulated local land use to balance the interests of their public and of industrial uses. In context with regard to other industries. Okay. The third clause, which is the second new clause, that local governments are entitled to protect their people and their communities using the precautionary principle. Again, this isn't the findings and purpose. This is not substantive. This clause was added directly in response to questions 6H and 6I, which asks if there is a risk so small that it does not require mitigation or so unsubstantiated with regard to the degree of risk that it cannot be regulated, and whether local governments bear the burden of proving an activity as risky. Petitioners have suggested that this is somehow an independent substantive change. However, it's not only not a substantive change, it's a well-defined legal principle. You can find it in any number of sources. It's a power that local governments already have in the context of their ability to regulate. Okay, the fourth and final new clause, thank you, in Section 1A reads that to protect these interests, the people desire to expand the authority of local governments by vesting in them the right to impose local restrictions on oil and gas development without fear of state preemption. Again, findings and purpose tells the court what we mean. This is not a substantive part of our amendment. This was added directly in response to question 6 generally. Again, question 6, I believe, has 9 subparts, which addresses the current balance of power between the state and local governments in regulating oil and gas. In sum, Section 1A was clarified and amended in direct response to the 4 pages of substantive and 2 pages of technical questions from the Legislative Council. Additionally and furthermore, since this purpose and finding sections is not substantive and that it does not have substantive effect, we believe that they cannot rise to substantial modifications in any case. All right. Section 1, purpose and findings, 1A. I have a list of cases. I don't know if you're probably very familiar with these cases. You hear them all the time. I don't know if you want me to go through them at all, but I have 2 pages just of case law with their relevant findings. If you want me, 3 pages if you want me to read them.
Please.
Okay. All right, I'll just skip those.
Believe you.
Yeah.
But I will say I appreciate how prepared you both are. Okay. Came to the hearing.
Thank you. So. All right, so let's see. So moving on to 1B. Our original version says that local governments in the state of Colorado may enact local charter amendments, laws, ordinances, and or regulations intended to protect the inalienable rights of citizens. I have underlined in the original parts that were modified, and I have also provided the amended version with the amendments also highlighted. As just discussed, Tying the local government to the concept of inalienable rights was problematic, ambiguous, and invited litigation. These concerns were expressed primarily in questions 2 and 6G by the Legislative Council. There were also questions about whether this section was intended to have substantive effect. Question 3A, that's why the purpose phrase in the amended version was added. The words rules such as is a simple clarification, lets people know that regardless of the form of the democratic process used to adopt some sort of restriction, that it will be included. The Legislative Council also expressed concerns over the element of intent conveyed by the original language. This was expressed in questions 3B1 and 6C in particular, although not exclusively. So this subsection was rewritten to clarify that it is not meant to have substantive effect. By including the purpose of this amendment is to empower all of Colorado's local governments. The word rule such as was added to clarify, okay, blah, blah, blah. Protecting inalienable rights was amended to remove the ambiguities and replaced with a list of protected interests, and intent was removed. A final phrase was added to the end in order to track the language of Section 3A as amended and clarifies the purpose of the amendment. A question asked by Legislative Council in question 1. And that is to say, sorry, we went through a couple pages there. One more. There you go. Through additional local restrictions on oil and gas development, including bans and moratoria on hydraulic fracturing. All right. Section 2, definitions. Section 2A is identical in both versions. Section 2B, with which the petitioners have expressed a great deal of concern, was added in direct response to question 4, which I can read for you. Under subsection 3, what does oil and gas development mean? Does it include oil and gas operations at every stage of the process, including exploration, production, storage, gathering, preliminary treatment, and waste disposal? Does it include so-called downstream activities associated with transmission and delivery pipelines, truck or rail transportation, and refining? I think that's a pretty broad definition that the Legislative Council asked us about. We answered their question. We provided a definition. All right. So, Section 3, grant of authority. Here's the original version. Notwithstanding any other amended sections in the original are underlined, and as they appear in the final version, the amendments are highlighted. You can see we removed the words in Colorado. That was in response to a technical question. We changed the word manner to the word method. That was in direct response to a suggestion of the Legislative Council. And then we changed the word, the use of hydraulic fracturing that are intended to protect their communities and citizens. We changed that to prohibitions and moratoria. This is in response to question 6E, which asked if we intended that a local government could prohibit an oil and gas practice such as hydraulic fracturing that a state law, including the commission's rules, allows operators to conduct. Again, the Legislative Council also expressed concerns with the element of intent and how this would be determined, who would determine it. Next. Yeah, thank you. So intended to protect their communities and citizens. In the Legislative Council questions, 6C and 3B1 in particular, they asked how is it determined whether a restriction is intended to protect their communities, who makes that determination, how is it determined whether a local charter amendment, blah, 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 is intended to protect the inalienable rights of citizens? Okay. So intent is problematic for Legislative Council. We felt it wasn't necessary. It throws in an extra point that invites litigation. So it's not necessary. We cut it out in direct response to those questions. So Section 3B and 3C look different, primarily because we flipped the order in response to question 8A of the Legislative Council. In the original version, it went grant, preemption, limitation on grant. We thought that the amended version made more sense to have the grant, then the limitation on the grant, and then the issue of preemption. The Legislative Council was confused by whether C was referring to the provisions of A or B, so yeah, so we flipped that around. Okay. 3B, the original says no local government may enact any blah, blah, blah on oil and gas development, less stringent. Okay. In the final version, we simplified that to rule. As we expressed in an earlier subsection, that we used that as a clarifying word on oil and gas. Okay, less stringent was changed to less protective of any interest, including public health, safety, or air water quality. This is in direct response to question 7, which has 4 subparts, which addresses who decides what is more stringent, how is stringency determined, and under what standard. So then I just repeated the question that, okay, so the change that we've done is both a direct response and a clarification. The interests to be protected are given in a list. That's a clarification. The word protective is used rather than stringent because stringent does not convey a standard for determining stringency, whereas we felt protective set forth its own standard. Fairly clear. The last change in 3B is to include concurrent local jurisdictions. That is in direct response to question 5, particularly 5A, which asks what happens if a local government with a jurisdiction over the same geographic area, e.g. a city and a county, place conflicting restrictions on the time, place, or method of oil and gas development. Okay, 3C, moving right along, original. We basically just simplified this by removing some of the extra language. We removed the word any, and we removed the words placed by local government on oil and gas development. Again, this is in reference to question 8A, but it's also a clarification. Because 3B and 3C exchange places, we believe that the ambiguity was removed. The word any was superfluous. While the original and the amended drafts appear superficially different, they accomplish the same goal, allowing local governments in Colorado to restrict oil and gas development without fear of state preemption. The Supreme Court has consistently allowed clarifications and amendments in response to the comments of the Legislative Council without resubmission. Clarifications and linguistic refinements are to be encouraged, and provisions are to be liberally construed to facilitate the people's right of constitutional initiative. Are there any questions about that?
Questions from the board?
I don't know how anybody could have any questions after that. No. I think I'm prepared for discussion myself.
Me too. Okay.
So we went through at least a chunk of this, not in quite so much detail last time, and I think the petitioners raised some very interesting points and arguments. There is a potential for kind of gaming the system, it seems to me, if you go with a kind of broadly worded measure, and then you get asked some kind of broad questions, and you suddenly come back and say, oh, that's a good question, and you come back with kind of a very detailed, somewhat different measure. That doesn't really seem to be what happened here. This strikes me as I think, a little bit of where Ms. Eubank's line of questioning was going. In most ways, this seemed to me that a measure was submitted that used some kind of general, potentially problematic language, as we just heard, and was asked some good questions, some fairly broad questions. And when you have broad questions, there's a lot you can do that's in response to them. And I think that there's problems whichever direction we go here. These seem to be all in response to questions. It did change the measure, but I think the way I view the process as working, it's not as if this went into a completely different direction without anybody having a chance to hear about it at the review and comment hearing. These all kind of, I'm not sure they're clarifications in the same sense, but they're changes that strike me as being in direct response. The one I think that is most troubling is I think the one Ms. Titus emphasized about altering or adding a definition of oil and gas development that is, to me, not what I normally consider to be development, but kind of a lot of processing, transporting, selling. On the other hand, the question was specifically, what do you mean by oil and gas development? Do you mean all these other things? And they decided that they did. So I guess it's not really our position to say that's a strange definition. It was in response to a question. So I think I'm still where I was before, some slight reluctance, but in general agreeing with the proponents of the measure that the changes, while substantive, were in response to the questions, and therefore I would be inclined to deny the motion on this basis.
Is that a no?
I don't know.
Well, I was the one, obviously, that brought up this issue at our first meeting, and especially my concern was in light that the changes that were made, especially on the legislative intent or declaration portion of the measure, subsection 1, very closely mirrored other initiated measures that were filed subsequent to this measure being filed for review and comment. But we discussed this at the initial meeting, and the proponents explained that they believed all the changes made were in direct response to questions posed during review and comment. We relied on that assurance, and based on the information that the proponents have provided today, I think that substantiates their claims. And so at this point, although I agree that, and to me, you know, there's a difference between substantial, which is the terminology in the statute, versus substantive changes. But although this may be pushing the envelope in terms of where do you draw the line in terms of the types of changes that can be made in direct response, especially in terms of very broad questions that were posed during review and comment, at this point in time, I'm comfortable in terms of the changes made being made in direct response to review and comment questions, and would deny the motion on that ground.
Then I'll go ahead and move then that we deny the motion for rehearing on the ground, the first ground that it is not in response, that it wasn't submitted essentially to the ledge council.
Second.
All right, all those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
All right, that moves us to the next issue for rehearing, and Ms. Titus can come back up and walk us through the multi-subject issue.
Thank you. We submit that the measure contains multiple just disjointed subjects that lack a single encompassing principle. I first just like to go back again to this definition of oil and gas development. This definition in and of itself creates a single subject problem in that it is so broad, it's not unlike other subjects that the Supreme Court has rejected, like limiting government spending or water. If you just begin with even one of the products specified in that definition, natural gas, the measure seeks to give local governments authority to regulate natural gas, including its extraction, processing, storage, and transportation. Even limiting the measure to this single product would violate the single subject rule because it seeks to grant local governments authority to regulate very distinct businesses and processes, including upstream exploration and development, midstream processing and refinery, transportation, could even include regulated utilities. But the measure doesn't stop there. It also seeks to expand local control to petroleum byproducts and specifically mentions asphalt. Asphalt and natural gas, I would submit, are two entirely different things that do not include the same subject. And perhaps what is most startling is the measure purports to give local governments carte blanche authority to regulate petroleum products, which could include thousands of commercial products and consumer products that are made from petroleum, including paints, tires, plastics, and fabrics. I mean, this measure is akin to a measure that attempts to regulate timber harvesting, but includes in its definition of timber all wood-based products, including byproducts such as paper. In either scenario, the vast number of products, processes, businesses, and industries that could be regulated by local government are too disconnected to fall within a single subject. I would also submit that the measure seeks to grant local governments two distinct types of authority. It talks about restricting the time, place, and manner of oil and gas development. And it also seeks to prohibit oil and gas, to allow local governments to prohibit oil and gas development. Time, place, and manner restrictions are typically used in the regulation of speech. It's unclear to me at this time how a time, place, or manner restriction would apply to oil and gas, but the case law regarding time, place, and manner restrictions is pretty clear. They are not a complete prohibition of whatever the practice is. They are a limitation only. This measure seeks to allow to local governments to do both prohibit and limit the time, place, and manner, and I would submit that those are distinct and separate purposes. The measure also attempts to exempt any, appears to attempt to exempt any local laws passed under this measure from preemption, changing the preemption analysis on this topic of oil and gas development. I would submit that is another purpose. And finally, going back to the precautionary principle that Ms. Tone highlighted for us earlier, as she mentioned, it's a distinct principle of law, and this measure purports to grant local governments authority to enact laws pursuant to this principle, and I would also submit that that's a separate and distinct purpose. These separate and distinct purposes violate the single subject rule and prevent the board from setting title.
Let's hear from the proponent. Unless the board had questions. Any questions?
No.
No, that's fine. Go ahead.
So on this issue, the rule is clear. The three leading cases say that amendments may not contain, quote, disconnected and incongruous measures. That's In re Breen. The various components of a measure must have a necessary or proper connection. Let's see. That's Catron v. Board of County Commissioners. And a bill comprises multiple subjects if it has at least two distinct purposes which are not dependent on or connected with each other. I had a little bit of a hard time responding to this because it was such a vaguely written petition in this section. She cited zero case law or cases to support her contention that these are unrelated issues, and in fact didn't cite anything showing what constitutes an unnecessary or improper connection. Our measure has a single purpose. It is to allow local governments to enact restrictions on oil and gas development. All of the provisions are clearly connected. There's nothing surreptitious. There's no independent subject that doesn't have a connection with the other portions of the measure. Do you have any questions about this?
I do have a question.
Okay.
And it's about what I mentioned a little bit ago as the what seemed to be the most substantive change in the measure, which is the kind of broad definition of oil and gas development. Development, to me, has a slightly different meaning than transportation of things like asphalt or that sort of thing. And that, to me, potentially raises a type of single subject problem in that it's misleading. I think our title may be misleading the way it's written now, because it doesn't explain the breadth of the definition. And perhaps we can solve that by changing the title. But when you're talking about storage or transportation of any petroleum products, right, including asphalt or waste, that's pretty broad, it seems to me. Is the intent of this really to tie all this to the development process, the extraction kind of storage, or is this meant to say we're going to regulate all refineries, anyone, you know, who has a propane storage or distribution center, asphalt companies, that that all this is meant to be dealt with in this measure? Because that is broader than what I consider to be oil and gas development.
I understand your concern. The problem is that oil and gas development in and of itself, under anyone's conception, involves multiple processes. It's unavoidable. You have drilling, you have casing, you have fracking, you have the flowback process, you have wastes from the flowback process. You have to take the gas out, you have to refine the gas, you have to, whatever they do, sweeten it, sour it, I don't know, sugarcoat it, compress it, pipe it around, store it, put odorants in it. I mean, there's a ton of stuff, and that's just for natural gas development. For oil development, you have other things going on. The COGCC has hundreds, if not thousands, of rules, and no one would argue that the COGCC regulates anything other than oil and gas development. I think that the way that local governments use this power, as it's been written, will have to be up to the local governments after the issue is passed, and that will have to be reviewed by the courts as to whether or not that activity that they're regulating reasonably falls within the definition of oil and gas. However, to exclude any of these processes would necessarily eliminate large portions of oil and gas development from the potential for regulation. For example, you know, you might say that storage is not a part of development, but clearly, you know, storage is a huge risk. A lot of communities don't want to take storing a lot of natural gas in their residential communities. That's one of the problems we're trying to address. Without that, you would have a measure which didn't fully encompass oil and gas development.
Right. I mean, I understand, but why someone might want all these things. And, you know, the way I read, if this were not defined as oil and gas development, you know, giving local governments the ability to regulate, for example, the transportation of petroleum products, could they ban driving gas trucks through town under this measure?
So under this measure, yes, but in the context of the law in general, you know, possibly not. That might raise Commerce Clause problems regulating the transport. You know, pipelines are federally regulated, and that's a, you know, pitfall that local governments will have to navigate when they're implementing their rules. It's not something for us to address today here in our measure, which empowers local governments.
Okay, well, I guess my point is that to me has little to do with oil and gas development, which is the problem I might have.
With all due respect, I mean, transport is a huge part of oil and gas development.
Right, but it's also part of things that are not considered oil and gas development, like oil and gas that's already been developed, refined, and is being moved around, right? That I don't normally consider being part of development unless you...
Sorry.
No, that's my only point. I mean, I understand why sort of fracking trucks and trucks coming from wells and all that is... That makes sense to me. Everything you said in your original response about all those processes. But this reaches those, and it seems to me, potentially a lot of other things, and that's what is the potential problem I have.
Yeah, we do. Sorry. With all due respect, I mean, the example that you give, transportation, is absolutely an essential part of oil and gas development. They are trucking around huge trucks full of toxic waste. They have large, I mean, transportation is one of the things that has the largest impact on local governments, on the degradation of roads, the safety issues, the traffic issues, the air quality issues created by thousands and thousands of trucks rolling through. Many of the spills, explosions, and other types of accidents that happen at the transportation process with the trucks and with the pipelines. You know, whether or not the local governments would, you know, take this ball and run so far with it that they might violate other portions of the law is not for us to say today. That is in the application of the law, which is not for us to decide. But absolutely, I mean, transportation is an essential part of oil and gas development. And without the ability to regulate the transportation of these products through a jurisdiction, local governments would not be able to protect themselves from some of the most severe local consequences of oil and gas development.
No, I agree with that. I agree that transportation is an important part of, if I were writing a measure about oil and gas development, I'd want to include transportation related to the oil and gas development process. The issue I have is this seems to reach transportation and storage of petroleum products that I don't consider to be part of the development process. That in addition to regulating potentially all the things you talked about, we're now talking about extensive regulation potentially outside of all of the types of things related to drilling and extracting and getting it from the wells to the refinery, et cetera. So that's my only, I'm not saying I disagree with you. I'm just wondering, to me, that's not, there's both transportation and storage related to development and not related to development, related to marketing and that sort of thing, that to me is potentially a problem. That's all. Cool.
We have exempted consumer retailers from our definition. We thought that attempting to impose, to include that in our definition of development would go too far. I would add one thing, which is, as Titus brought up, the fact that developers, she said, appears only in one place. I would note that the word development appears extensively throughout, and I think it's pretty clear to most English speakers that developers would be people who engage in development. So that's just one little note.
I mean, it would be clear, except then in your definition, you go further and you say, and it's all going to be controlled by the definition, right? I mean, everything's in the definition. And in the definition, it says transport petroleum products. And usually when you think of development, I think you might think of it akin to manufacturing. You manufacture a product. Once the product's done, that's the manufacturing of it. What happens after that product is complete? So in this case, the gas, I mean, if you load it up into a truck, is that really part of the development? Well, you've included it in this definition.
Right. Yes. You know, the point at which development becomes retail, I don't think it's actually as fuzzy. And I think, you know, part of the problem of going with a quote-unquote layperson's understanding, whatever that is, we don't even know what that is. You know, most people don't have a layperson's understanding of what oil and gas development is.
Well, I'm not even talking about the layperson's understanding. I'm talking about the jurisdictional issue of does that make it two subjects to tie in this whole issue of transportation into then this, what is potentially another issue of development, because we don't have to look at the layperson standard to find a definition of development or a definition of manufacturing. Those are pretty well, you know, litigated out in the law. And generally it stops once the product is made. So you take your molecules, you take your, you know, whatever, and you put it in part A and it comes out part B, and
that process is finished. Once you start tagging on this additional regulation, are you creating two subjects? That's really what we're talking about from a legal sense. Are you creating something that is potentially surreptitious, that people don't understand that the development could potentially stop the transport?
Well, I think that, you know, again, at the point when the gas becomes a finished product, that's when it's entered into commerce, and that's when it, you know, would cease to be probably in development.
Well, it would, except for you defined it differently.
I disagree. I think we've said that transportation is, you know, is clearly included when it's part of the development process. We've exempted, you know, consumer retailers, so at the point when it would be a finished product that they're transporting around, that would be not in the development process. I think we're getting into the weeds a little bit here. I think that local governments will be able to obviously discern the difference between, you know, the gasoline truck that's coming to fill up the pumps, or, you know, Xcel Energy, who's pumping natural gas to your home, from Encana or Anadarko, who are transporting trucks full of hazardous waste, well, not defined as hazardous waste, but it is hazardous and it is waste, being transported through their jurisdictions. So, you know, how do you split that baby? You know, it's true, that is a hard question. But clearly, if you don't include the transportation element, you are missing out on a large segment of the impacts from development that no one could disagree is development.
So let me ask a question that maybe I'm just misunderstanding. Is it your intent, the proponent's intent, that the idea of development in either a common sense or whatever sort of way it's used is meant as a limiting principle for the idea of transportation, that it's not just all transportation of petroleum products, like, you know, plastic toys and that sort of thing, or even a little bit less extreme, I think, as you just said, you know, the trucks driving around to fill up the pumps are transporting petroleum products. So, but I hear you, I think, telling us the intent is that that would not be covered. And the only way I can get there, I think, is if we view the common sense or whatever, maybe there is none, the kind of jargon sense of oil and gas development, the extraction process, the fracking process, the disposal of the process of pulling it out of the ground, getting it to the refinery, maybe, where
the transportation,
that's a limiting principle on the rest of the definition. Is that the intent?
I believe so, yes.
Okay, thank you.
And if I could just jump in here for a sec,
please.
In terms of clarification of the example in terms of a tanker truck coming to the gas station, I mean, in my mind, and perhaps I'm overly technical, that isn't a retail, that's a wholesaler. And so when you say retailers of petroleum products, to me, that's the gas station. And so, you know, whether or not up to that point, it could be regulated. And it's only the retail sale by the gas station that is excluded by retailers. Because, I mean, and like I say, I may be overly technical just because of the nature of my work, but to me, a wholesaler versus a retailer is different.
I see what you're getting at. I'm not sure that this question does rise to the multiple subject issue. It's, you know, they asked us for a definition, and they asked us if specifically if this, and this are included. Our answer was yes, we included them explicitly. We don't feel that there's a multiple subject problem. Any problems with interpretation are a question for later, we believe. And split it, again, it's, you know, it's splitting the baby. That's what courts do. that's not something that can happen in every, you know, amendment or ballot process.
So can I make a suggestion that in this instance it might be useful for us to look at the title? Because to me, that helps me focus on the issues I'm having, which are that we understood this last time to be consistent with the answer we just got, that all of this is limited to this concept of development that we last time sort of viewed as kind of something that the people who read this would understand, didn't need any further definition. And to me, that incorporates this idea that development is a limiting principle on the potentially broad definition. That seems to me to be how we wrote the title, understanding it last time. The petitioners for rehearing, I think, have raised a strong point, and we've just spent plenty of time discussing it, about whether that's accurate or not. So my point is, if the petitioners are right about the way that definition should be read, that it's very broad and that it's in everything other than retailers, you're running a risk, if we adopt this title, that it's misleading. I think if the definition is broad, this is probably a misleading title. If the definition is meant to be limited, the way we just talked about, then I'm basically okay with this title. So that's kind of where I am. If we think it has to be written more broadly, then I think we have problems. If we're going to go with our previous kind of understanding of the way the definition worked, that it was limited by the idea of development, I'm basically okay both that there's not a single subject and that the title is basically okay. I do think the proponents run a risk that the Supreme Court disagrees with that interpretation, and there are a number of problems that that could create for them if we were to go with this idea. If we think we need to change it, then that raises both the issue of changing it and the potential single subject question.
And that's really why I would probably not advocate for changing it, because I think if it is going to be read that broadly, then it does create two subjects, and I'm not sure I really see the point of writing the title more broadly. I mean, it either is limited and it's one subject or it's not. We're going to go ahead and let her. You can. Why don't you make your last pitch?
My last point was, you know, it's clearly not our intent to include paint products or rubber duckies in the meaning of oil and gas development. I think another way that you can look at it is that oil and gas development, the problem that we're seeking to address here is that the state has claimed a preemption power over local governments in this specific context of oil and gas development. This measure is seeking to fix that problem for local governments. You know, I would say that you could almost say that development is bounded by what the state has claimed preemption over. You know, the state doesn't claim that it has preemption over rubber duckies and paint products. You know, it says oil and gas because there's, quote, state interests in the production of oil and gas. And I think that's just another way to read the limitation, so that it's a common sense, you know, but also, you know, it is common sense, but obviously we couldn't limit it to common sense. We had to have a definition, but I think that the reading of the definition should be limited by common sense.
Go ahead. You can just state your name again for the record. Just
Elizabeth Titus on behalf of the objectors, excuse me. In interpreting the definition, I think that we have to look at the plain text of the definition. I mean, I understand what proponents are saying now, but that is not the words that are on the page. It says, oil and gas development includes all physical or chemical processes, procedures used to explore for, extract, process, produce, store, or transport petroleum products, including natural gas, and asphalt and waste. So I don't think that, you know, it's a nice idea to say, well, this is limited by the term development, but the term oil and gas development is in quotes, and it is inclusive of all of the things that are listed there. And I think it would be a huge stretch to say that, to say now, well, these terms are limited by the term development, when really the term development, according to the plain language, includes all of these things that petitioners, the proponents list. As far as, you know, what the definition of oil and gas development is, you know, I believe that in the Oil and Gas Act, that oil and gas development is defined. Oil and gas development the proponents could have used a more narrowly tailored definition, but they did not. They say that they got their definition in response to a comment from Legislative Council, where Legislative Council asked them, do you mean to include all of this huge range of stuff? And they have essentially answered, yes. So I submit that this violates the single subject rule, but that if the board construes this to be a single subject, that this definition needs to be included in the title because it's so broad that the general public, the public should be made aware of all the processes that this could include and all of the products. And I at the appropriate time, I have a submission of our idea of what a title might look like, but I'm just not sure if we're there yet.
All right, thanks. Comments on the single subject?
I think where I am on single subject is I believe that the measure constitutes a single subject. And the reason is that you have a term, defined term, oil and gas development. Yes, it's very broad. Whether the public needs to be given notice of that is a different matter. And the reason that I think that it's a single subject is just in contrast, if you had a measure before us that was basically the same kind of concept that a local government could override any issue of statewide concern. They wanted to get rid of the fact that the state could preempt on any matter. I think you could have a measure as a single subject doing that. And so the fact that this measure is doing that in regard to oil and gas development and it's defined that term broadly, I think that's still a single subject, even though it's very broad. Then it becomes, you know, down the road a matter of interpretation of where do you draw the line and all of that and whether or not we should modify the title to give more notice about that broad definition. But at this point, I think it's a single subject.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the main thing that troubles me is that the title we wrote and our whole discussion last time seemed to assume something that Ms. Eubank's interpretation doesn't include or is different, and I'm a little bit troubled by that. And I guess to me, if we took out of 2B the defined term and just said, if the measure just said state governments shall have the power to regulate or limit all physical or chemical processes or procedures used to explore, extract, process, produce, store, or transport petroleum products, including gas products such as byproducts such as asphalt or waste. I'm not sure that would be a single subject violation, sort of for the reasons that Ms. Eubanks said. Those are all related to one another, even under the broad interpretation. The problem is whether they become kind of surreptitiously hidden, or parts of them do, by fitting them into a term that I think has a different meaning at this point. And that's where I get concerned, and why I said if we left it this way, it seems to reflect the proponent's intent, but the language, as Ms. Titus has pointed out, seems to point to a somewhat broader definition. That leaves me in a sort of difficult position. I suppose we could simply rewrite the title to more to reflect the definition, and leave it at that, even though I think that would leave it open to a lot of arguments that I'm not sure the proponents actually intended to include, but I'm not sure that we can fix that problem.
I think that's an issue that's for a campaign and judicial interpretation at some point in time. I don't think that's something that we can address.
I think in order to write the title, the subject would have to be an amendment increasing the authority to restrict time, place, manner of oil and gas development and transportation. I mean, I just don't think it's really about oil and gas development. And I mean, maybe because it's a subset of something broader that you can do, but I still think it creates two pretty distinct things, and you could potentially have a regulation of an entire industry and scheme that's sort of hidden in the... I mean, I think when most people think about these oil and gas development questions, they're going to think of the land, and they're going to think of impacts to the land, and they're not going to be thinking of the traffic and the impact to the roadways or traffic accidents or that kind of thing. So I think the way the definition is written, I think the opponents make a good point that it's creating two pretty distinct topics.
With all due respect, I mean, the definition is broad, as I mentioned, because oil and gas development is a very wide set of processes. They are exploring for and extracting and storing and transporting, processing many, many different types of substances. They just are. There's shale oil, oil shale, oil sands, tar sands, natural gas, crude oil, light crude, heavy crude. I mean, at some point, it gets a little bit ridiculous trying to fit every single thing into the title of a ballot initiative when, you know, I don't think anyone would say, you know, without the transportation element, for example, you can't develop oil and gas without the transportation element. I understand that not all types of transportation, see, there's two different ways to come at it. Maybe not all types of transportation are oil and gas development. You have passenger cars that probably aren't oil and gas development. But on the other hand, you can't have oil and gas development without some elements of transportation in it. To restrict our definition or to say that it creates multiple subjects or to say that it's so broad or not understandable that it somehow all needs to go in the title so as not to be misleading. I think that that's looking at it in the wrong way.
Well, but I mean, that could have been fixed by saying transportation necessary for the development. Instead, you set transportation off as a separate kind of clause. And that's my problem with it, is I don't think you limited it to just the development. I think you opened up a second thing that doesn't necessarily have to do with development.
I believe, aren't they all separated by commas? I'm sorry, I don't have that clause in front of me on these papers that I have.
Yeah, I was just looking at it. I mean, it says, includes all physical or chemical processes or procedures required to explore for, extract processes, produce, store, or transport products.
Required to, I think, is definitely a clarifying phrase.
Required to.
Again.
Doesn't use that.
Oh, sorry. No, you. Used. I don't see that. Yep.
Used to.
Used to. All right. Well, used to is still does substantially the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think the problem, obviously, that we're having is if you strip out some of the sort of other language that has all the commas, this would say that this gives local governments the power to regulate any process used or procedure used to store or transport petroleum products. That's broad and is not limited to what normally is considered oil and gas development. I think at this point, what I think probably we need to do is, I think I agree with Ms. Eubanks that even that broad definition is probably not a separate subject, but I think we need to rewrite the title to be not tied to the words oil and gas development, because I do think this includes things that under the, until this becomes law, are not generally considered development, or at least we're engaging in too much of our own interpretation as it is now. And I'd be inclined to just not to strip that language out and just say to restrict the time, place, and manner of all physical or chemical processes or procedures used to explore, extract, and just quote the rest of that sentence. That's the only way I think I can get there.
Well, do you want to do the single subject?
So I guess I'll move that we find that the measure has a single subject.
And deny the motion for rehearing.
And deny the motion for rehearing on that particular basis.
Second.
Okay, all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? No. All right, that takes us to the title.
Oh, yeah, sorry. You can have those. Oh.
Elizabeth Titus again for the petitioners. I agree with Mr. Domenico that the title needs to reflect what the proponents mean by oil and gas development. Otherwise, the title fails to include a very important aspect of the measure. I would also submit that the title should reflect that local governments have authority pursuant to the precautionary principle, and that there be language included at the end of the measure, which further clarifies the limitations on local governments to enact such rules. And I have a proposal, if you don't mind.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I take a little opposite view of what you had stated, that it should reflect the intent. And I guess I just like your comment on it. I think it should just reflect the language, because I don't think we can rely on the intent.
Fair enough. The intent as expressed using the plain language. I think that the intent of the measure is clear from the language, and that at the very least, the definition of oil and gas development needs to be included. So I would ask that instead of oil and gas development, well, actually, I would move the including prohibitions and moratoria phrase to right after restrict time, place, and manner, including including prohibitions and moratorium of the methods used to explore for, extract, process, produce, store, or transport petroleum products, byproducts, or waste.
Okay. When she's done making her comments, we'll let you get out.
And then after that, I would have, in connection therewith, deeming such local restrictions not to be in conflict with the state's interest and prohibiting local governments from enacting rules regarding such methods that are less protective of any interest than existing other Colorado federal or concurrent local jurisdiction.
Okay. All right. Thank you. The proponents want to respond.
First, generally, we just like to say that because Ms. Titus and her petitioners that she's representing are intending to challenge us on this title to the Supreme Court, we don't think that they should be allowed to write the title that they're about to challenge us on. We think that theirs is too long, overly confusing, and would be difficult for voters to discern the true effect of the initiative. We think that the title, as set by the title board, more properly reflects the true effects of the initiative as we've written it. I don't see why we should use 20 words when 6 will suffice. For example, just in the last clause that Ms. Titus has suggested, and prohibiting local governments from enacting rules regarding such methods that are less protective of any interest than any other existing Colorado federal concurrent local jurisdiction. I mean, we've pretty much said that in 6 words up there. I don't see why we need to get to 3 lines on that one issue. You know, again, we would just reiterate that oil and gas development is not so broad. We would like to note that the COGCC, which regulates only oil and gas development, contains 14 pages of definitions for the various oil and gas processes that they regulate.
All right, thanks. Mr. Domenico loves regulations, so.
That's right. Well, so my thoughts were, I agreed with, as I mentioned a little bit ago, I think, one of the points that the objectors suggested about the definition. And there's another potential change that I thought we might consider those. That's not really in the objector's proposal, but was triggered by something mentioned hours and hours ago, it seems like, about time, place, and manner restrictions. But for the most part, I agree with Ms. Tone about the last. I'm not inclined to add the last sentence. I'm not inclined to add the language about the precautionary principle. I am inclined to consider adding or altering the language about oil and gas development to reflect the language of the measure, and to change potentially the idea of time, place, and manner to something a little bit simpler. I don't know if those are way off base. I'm happy to consider other things. If they're basically acceptable, I'll make some specific proposals.
Yeah, and I mean, I agree. I think if we include the definition of oil and gas development, then we can just strike time, place, and manner because it's essentially defined.
Yeah, so that was basically what I was going to suggest would be that basically what's all of almost all of line 2 now would be to restrict. It could also be changed to regulate or prohibit, or to restrict, regulate, or prohibit, however we want to say it, and then we could maybe save the other language about prohibitions.
Right.
And then I I would just jump straight into, I'm not sure we need to say physical or chemical, say something about any processes, and then just quote essentially that whole first, the rest of the whole first sentence of 2B, which is basically what I think the proposal is here. Then it would say processes or procedures used to explore for, extract, process, produce, store, or transport petroleum products. And then we could talk about whether the including clause should be in there, including natural gas byproducts such as asphalt or waste. That's my suggestion.
I think we as the proponents don't have as much objection to including some parts or maybe even all of the definition of included in oil and gas development. I think shorter is clearer, but I think leaving in oil and gas development makes it more clear to the layperson, so they don't have to get all the way to the end of because the processes described used to produce petroleum products that comes too far at the end. And I think you've held before in other initiatives that placing important things too far at the end can be misleading.
Yeah, I just don't know how else it would flow. Go ahead.
Yeah, I have to say that I agree with Mr. Domenico's proposal. Oil and gas development here, because it's because of the definition, isn't what I would think many of us would typically think of oil and gas development, including the general public. So we do need to include the definition. And I would say, just reiterate that, just start with the methods used to explore for, extract, processes, produce, store, or transport petroleum products, I think needs to be in there as well, byproducts or waste. I mean, it's pretty broad, and I think that the public needs to be aware of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's at least worth writing it down to look at it. I understand the proponent's concern, and it's true, we do try to put the more important things at the front, but that's much more of a concern with long titles. This is still going to be relatively short for this crowd, and so I'm not sure it's as much of a concern as it could be elsewhere.
You could put oil and gas, comma, which includes the methods used to explore for, and that way that would at least bring it up to the top.
You can go ahead.
Well, I wonder if we need to go back to the
in connection
with style. Yeah. That might be causing us a bit of a problem.
Right.
My concern is, I think oil and gas development as a single subject is probably misleading, and so I'm not sure what I would put in as concerning what local government regulation of what?
Oil and gas. And then in connection therewith.
Petroleum products.
Yeah.
I mean, that the problem.
No. I think you just got to put in oil and gas and then in connection therewith.
I think that that raises, though, the comment that Ms. Eubanks made that the single subject as approved by the board is the methods used to explore for, extract, process, produce, store, transport petroleum products. I mean, that's what got us to this point that we are right now. And so that needs to be included in the single subject of the initiative.
And You know, we reserve our objections to that conclusion, but however, all I'm trying to address here is that oil and gas development, if you're going to include the definition that we've provided, which it seems like we're inclined to do, we should at least put the phrase that's being defined before the definition that we're giving for it, if that makes sense. Because to have oil and gas development all the way at the bottom with the methods used to explore for, et cetera, at the top, I think is just unnecessarily confusing.
All right, so then it would look like on line two, the methods used Yeah, so it could be it could just say to restrict, regulate, or prohibit oil and gas development, which includes all blah, blah, blah.
I think that's better.
No, I don't like including raises the problem I have with it. All, and then I would quote the rest. I would quote all of 2B, except for I don't think I would include the exception for retail.
No.
And I think we were also going to remove the including prohibitions and moratoria. We're going to delete that, strike that from the end, since we've included that above.
So do you have 2B, Steve? Do you want me to read it to you? Oil and gas development. Physical or chemical processes. Up until before it says the exception. So it'd be physical or chemical processes or procedures used to explore for, extract, process, produce, store, or transport petroleum products, including natural gas byproducts such as asphalt or waste.
And with due respect, that's more verbiage than was even suggested by the petitioners. So I think that's getting perhaps a little carried away.
But as you pointed out, they're not writing the title for us. So
that is true. Touche. All right.
Well, I do think you could get rid of the methods. Includes all. And probably, I don't know. You could get rid of processes, or and I'd be okay with it.
I don't need byproducts. I mean, I don't need the whole thing either. I just want to make sure we get in that transport and.
Yeah, so we need to change prohibitions and moratoria now to either just stop right there or to have the including.
Well, I mean, we have regulate and prohibit up there, which is essentially
right.
Well, a moratoria or a prohibition, right? So can't we just get rid of it?
Yeah, that's probably what I would do.
My apologies. Is there a problem now with the word restrictions being used at the end, where the beginning contains restrictions, restrict, regulate, or prohibit? Does the restrictions in the final sentence, or second to last line, does that encompass all of the things that were mentioned in line two?
Well, we can have the same discussion Mr. Gellender and I had about whether regulation includes all these concepts.
You could say restrictions including regulations or prohibitions, and then such local restrictions would refer to all of the restrictions, regulations, or prohibitions.
Yeah, I think I'm okay probably either way. It's kind of lawyer talk probably to try to distinguish a regulation from a restriction. And I think we're supposed to be talking to people who don't necessarily make those distinctions, but I don't mind including it probably.
And actually, now that we're on the subject, I think at the last title board hearing, we did eliminate the word regulate as potentially misleading because it could imply the ability for local governments to set lower thresholds for regulation than the state or other, federal concurrent local jurisdictions have provided for. So since they can restrict but they can't loosen, I think regulate is potentially misleading.
Perhaps it's just easier to stay with restriction because that's the terminology of the measure.
Okay.
Both at the beginning and then there in the last phrase.
Just get rid of regulate or prohibit.
I think we're okay with keeping including prohibitions. Yeah. We don't want this to be misleading any more than anyone else does.
You restrict, comma, including
restrict or prohibit?
But those are within the set of restrictions. I mean, as your measure is written, that local governments may restrict, including but not limited to prohibitions or moratoria. So to me, restrictions covers everything that your measure covers.
If I may.
I think that the idea that this initiative could result in not just restrictions implies restrict, but could still allow the activity to take place. I think that the voters need to know that this initiative would give local governments the power to ultimately prohibit. I mean, that's the most important word for us. So I would say restrict or prohibit or just prohibit.
Well, if you feel like you have to include all three, then you say restrict, prohibit, or suspend, because that's what a moratorium is. And then you have to do that perhaps in both places, if you think that's important.
I feel like the suspension would fit within restriction.
And I think it fits within a prohibition. It's just a temporary prohibition. So, I mean, I think restrict or prohibit is a good idea. I tend to agree suspend is probably not necessary because I guess it's one or the other.
Temporary prohibition.
Kind of a, right. That's, there's actually
that's fine.
A.
I
so, and then the question is, do we need to expand the restrictions on line 5? I don't
think so, because if you're prohibiting it, then...
Right.
I mean, obviously, that's...
I think it's important to make it clear at some point that what we're talking about, that I agree, a prohibition is a kind of restriction. I also understand that it's not necessarily there. You could interpret restriction otherwise. But since we've already said what we mean by restrictions, including a prohibition, I don't think it's necessary down there.
I'm fine with that.
Yeah. All right. You want to collapse it and I'll read it? As it reads right now, it's an amendment to the Colorado Constitution increasing the authority of local governments to restrict or prohibit oil and gas development, which includes all physical or chemical procedures used to explore for, extract, process, produce, store, or transport petroleum products, byproducts, or waste, and deeming such local restrictions not to be in conflict with the state interests.
And I would move that the remainder of the motion for rehearing be denied except for the changes as reflected in the title that you just read.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
All right. Thank you.
And that takes us to motion for rehearing on initiative 2013-2014, number 68. Yeah. You want to change your mind on lunch?
No. Ken Tyson's here, so.
Oh.
We'll switch out when we're done.
Is it just this one?
Yeah.
And then you're
done?
Oh, okay. We'll take a lunch break after this. Yeah. And for anyone else that's here, we're going to take like a half hour lunch break at around noon. So I think it's very unlikely we're going to get past number 41 before noon, and then we'll reconvene at 12:30. So if anybody wants to go beyond number 41, feel free to have a more leisurely lunch. All right, Mr. Gruskin, you're here on number 68, so you're stuck.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Mark Gruskin. I'm here on behalf of Holly Terry, the objector to the ballot title set. The grounds were laid out in the motion for rehearing that we filed. One is a jurisdictional ground, and the other addressed the accuracy and completeness of the ballot title. And I assume you'd like me to address jurisdiction?
Jurisdiction first, please.
The statutes, 1-40-105, Ren 4, requires that a proponent or proponents, in order to invoke this the jurisdiction of this board, submit their original and amended and a final draft. While there were three drafts that were submitted, the amended draft, frankly, is a hodgepodge of accurate and inaccurate reflections of changes. And I can only give you a smattering of some of them because they're frankly more difficult to follow than I was able to come up with an absolute and comprehensive list. But for instance, proponents' declaration is now two paragraphs long. The first paragraph basically didn't exist when they submitted their original version, but their highlighted version doesn't show that. It shows a few words that have been highlighted, and that is all. Then you go to the next page there, subsection 4A is shown as entirely new language on their amended version. In fact, it is not. It is largely original language with a new last sentence and a couple of verbiage changes beyond that. You move on to subparagraph 5. There are provisions that are not highlighted that were changed, important ones. For instance, the requirement that this entity be a 501c3 nonprofit. If you were looking at the amended version, you would think that that was in the original language. It was not. There are other provisions in there, and you also have, in for example, paragraph 6, you have language that is shown as highlighted and therefore changed on the amended version that was not. The word euthanasia is highlighted and would indicate that that was a change. It was not a change. And I could go on and on. You understand where I'm going. If you go even to the next page, subparagraph B, that is shown as highlighted, but in fact, it is either entirely or largely unchanged from the original draft. So this is... this isn't an amended draft. I don't know what this is. It is something else, but it doesn't comply with the statute. Absent that compliance, I would suggest that the jurisdiction of this board hasn't yet been properly invoked and would ask you to send these drafts back to the proponents for resubmission in a way that complies with the statute.
Thank you. Are proponents present?
Yes.
Okay. I don't have any comment on...
jurisdiction.
Petitioner's comment, yes.
Yes. The title board, by moving on this thing and examining the three particular drafts, the final, the amended, and the original, apparently was able to understand the highlighted version of the proposal and thereby accepted jurisdiction on it. If we refer to some case law on this, it says the title board has discretion to set titles and summary of proposed admissions. Failure to indicate all the differences between the original and the final version of the measure submitted to the Secretary of State does not cause them to lose jurisdiction. And that is the matter of Prop Initiative Construction Amended 1996, 917 Pacific 2nd, 1274. Also, the objector relied upon the case of cited in the statement that this case backed up the requirements of the CRS 140-105 print 4. In this particular case, which is the Phillips Buckley case, the initiative concerned the elimination of limits on funding of public schools, and the proponents submitted an original form, which was later amended and highlighted, and then it was amended again, but it wasn't highlighted, it was just upper and lower cased, and the fourth time it was amended again and no indicated changes were made to the title board. And the title board refused to take jurisdiction and went to the court. The court concurred with the action and affirmed it. So we firmly believe that there was sufficient information presented to the title board between the first and the second edition, indicated by highlighting or otherwise, that enabled them to understand where the changes were made, and that is the purpose of the highlighting, in order for them to set title on this matter. So I believe that the title board did accept and did take jurisdiction, and that which was proper, as the CRS 1-40-105 print 4 was complied with by the proponents of amendment number 68.
Thank you. Any questions? Oh, go ahead.
Brief response, Madam Chair. The purpose of the amended version is not to allow you to set a title. That's what the final version allows you to do. The purpose of the amended version is to allow you to allow the public to take a look and see whether or not the changes that were made were in fact made in direct response to the review and comment memo. And frankly, it's impossible to take a look at the changes because you don't know what changes were made. In order to discern whether or not that statutory requirement that the board's already discussed has in fact been complied with. There is a public education purpose here, as well as a compliance with the review and comment process here. And the idea isn't, if the idea was only that you got something that had yellow marking on it, you wouldn't need an amended version. You would just need something else. The idea for setting a title requires that you get the final version that you can rely on for setting that title. But the rest of us, and you, need to know whether or not this is in fact reflective of the review and comment memo. And I have to be honest with you, I cannot tell. I cannot tell you because this amended version does not make it possible in and of itself to discern. And so I would suggest to you that the purpose is very different. And yes, you were able to use the final version, but not in a way that you would have needed to in order to hold it up against the review and comment memo.
Yeah, briefly.
Yes. It's very clear that the final version submitted by the proponents in this matter followed almost perfect to a T the legislative comments and recommendations. So it was a very clean use of what the legislative staff commented upon, and the final version was a very clean and excellent adherence to what they were recommending us to do.
Thank you. Discussion?
Well, I'll start by saying I think that this part of the statute is generally viewed as a substantial compliance thing. I do think Mr. Gruskin raises some question about whether that standard has been complied with here. But I also, without kind of any sort of specific idea that somehow there's an actual problem underlying it, just a sort of inaccurate amended text leaves me, that seems like less than what we need to say we don't have jurisdiction over something. If we were to be able to say, well, the amended text kind of hid the fact that all these extensive changes were made that would have deprived the board of jurisdiction had they been able to figure it out, that's a little bit different to me.
Well, you know, I'm pretty used to looking at drafts of statutory or constitutional language that show changes, usually by strike type and small caps. I don't think the statute requires that. It talks about highlighting or other method of indicating changes. So I don't think, while it's, I agree with Mr. Gruskin, it is done in a somewhat confusing manner. I think he made reference to the first portion of the declaration, subsection 1, which I believe in the original was actually a proposed ballot title, part of the that language. And so it was moved, although it was not indicated that it was now all new language. It only showed the changes from the ballot title that was included in the original file for review and comment. I, too, had difficulty in ascertaining what was actual changes. Like Mr. Gruskin said, there's areas shaded that contains language that was original. There are provisions in the original that were completely taken out that aren't reflected as not even shading to indicate that something was there and had been removed. I do agree with Mr. Domenico that I believe it's a substantial compliance standard. I don't believe that the court would require proponents of an initiated measure to show changes in such an exacting manner as perhaps a legislative attorney would. And so saying that and understanding there's two purposes to be served. One is in terms of the public having knowledge of the changes that were made, and the purpose of liberally construing the matter so that proponents have and preserve their right to initiate a measure. I think at this point, I'm willing to say that it's substantial compliance.
Then I move that we deny the motion for a hearing on that jurisdictional point.
I second it.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All right. I think that that takes us to the title.
Correct. There are a number of issues we've raised. I know that you've reviewed in the motion for rehearing regarding the accuracy and the completeness of the title. I imagine that you dealt with this issue of is it a tax or is it a fee last time. I have no doubt that based on the rest of your calendar, you're anxious to deal with it again. However, I've got to raise it because it seems to me that to the extent it's an either-or question, either it is a Tabor question, and I think you've determined that it is, shall taxes be increased, and you've used the appropriate language there. But then you say later on in the next line, by the imposition of a fee on sales. It can't be both. It cannot be both. It has to be one or it has to be the other. If it's a Tabor question, and we think it is, it has to be represented as a tax on sales of pet animals. If it is a fee, then you are improperly using Article 10, Section 20, Paragraph 4. I leave that to your expertise, but my point isn't that you need to weigh in as to a major Tabor question. My point is that you cannot portray it both as a tax and as a fee. It is simply confusing to voters. And not expecting that you would necessarily want me to keep popping up for each of my rounds, maybe let me just run through them. The truth is, this is a tax that applies to every single sale of a pet animal, and the title ought to so reflect it. The title, I believe, ought to reflect the magnitude of the tax, which is 15%. The title ought to reflect, and this was an issue because originally the measure actually allocated ownership of these animals to the state. Then, based on review and comment, ownership was allocated to the shelters or animal rescues. Well, that obviously was an important issue, so important that it was put in the measure, taken out of the measure, and specified to be an ownership issue only of the entity, not of the state or of the original owner. There are significant provisions relating to allocating the liability for harm, and I think that those ought to be clarified. Grounds 6, 7, and 8 are all about the issue of what is and what isn't covered. Homeless pet isn't found in this measure. Homeless pet isn't found in state statute. Homeless pet is I would suggest to you, because it is neither used nor found, neither used in the measure nor found in statute, is a political rather than an informative statement, and is frankly not accurate. Those aren't necessarily homeless pets. Those are simply pets that end up at these facilities, but they aren't necessarily homeless. And finally, we think that the magnitude of the enforcement mechanism is relevant for voters to know, both in terms of penalties and the nature of civil remedies available for this private right of action, an entirely new animal, if you will.
So if they're not homeless pets, they're adoptable? What are they?
Unclaimed?
Unclaimed.
Why not just animals?
Well,
they surely can't euthanize just someone who's left them there on purpose. Or can they euthanize? Maybe that's a question for the proponents. Can I take my pet there and ask them to euthanize it?
Yes.
So, well, wait a minute. I mean, I guess maybe that's not a change.
I mean, then it's not a homeless pet.
If you look at the text of the measure, and I believe it's in subsection 3. Let me just, I have so many different versions marked up. So it's in 3580.106.3, subsection 3, where it's talking about any pet animal held by or in the custody of a licensed animal shelter or held by animal rescue and not reclaimed, and that's why I sort of proposed maybe unclaimed, that it's unclaimed pets. So if they haven't been reclaimed by the owner, then this provision provisions apply, so that's why I suggested maybe unclaimed pets.
Okay.
But
what do you think of that word, Mr. Gruskin? Yeah, I'm just, he's just trying to get all of his issues out of the way, and then we'll talk to you about your reasons.
Makes the record a little bit easier when it goes up on appeal.
I think that to the extent that the use of unclaimed or not reclaimed is a clear reference to the fact that these are animals that are held or held by either the shelter or the animal rescue, I think that, that's significantly improved.
Okay. All right. All right. The proponents want to come up and just respond in generally to what Mr. Gruskin had to say.
As far as the ownership, that's already in the statute. So that...
thank you. That basically doesn't change. And looking over the requirements of titles, there's one instance where the there were 500 words in the whole initiative, and after adding and adding and adding, they had 350 words in the title. So I think we really have to take a look at it, brevity, and that's the key element in this thing. As long as the title is fairly expresses the intent and meaning of what the proponents are trying to say, there sometimes is confusion about what might be misleading titles. But that's whether there should be a yes for or no against title. As far as the objector adding into the wants to add the new tax applies to all pet animals and that the new tax is 15% of, and I think we could go on and keep adding and adding and adding, but I think what the title board did at the last hearing was try to take it and make it a very brief, concise, and fair title. And I believe that's what they did at that particular time. The use of the term homeless pet, the Dumb Friend League says we save more than 16,000 homeless pets a year. The Humane Society of the United States says help homeless pets hold a fundraiser.
Yeah, but I think the whole point is that Mr. Gruskin is making is that becomes a catchphrase because those places are using it to fundraise. I mean, they use the word that is going to bring the most emotion or bring the most money in. They're going to use the word homeless pet. And we can't use catchphrases in the title that,
sure,
you know, make people feel emotional about issues. And so that's why we went down that road. So I understand people use it, but I'm not sure that helps your argument because I think people use it in a way that creates that catchphrase.
I just want to add that if we went with unclaimed pets, that doesn't fit the whole jurisdiction of everything we're going at because it's unclaimed, it's abandoned, it's surrendered. So do we have to put in there unclaimed, abandoned, surrendered animals, or do we say basically once an animal is in the custody and care of an animal shelter, it is homeless. That is its home. It does not have a home anymore. So to me,
But that's not true because you can get your pet taken to an animal shelter and it's not deemed unclaimed for a week or however long the shelter holds the pet to see if someone's going to come in and claim it.
But I don't understand why we need any adjective. It's not like if you take it to a shelter for 3 days, they can euthanize it, right? You say, I'll be back in 3 days, and they're not allowed to euthanize it. I would just leave it. They're
yes,
not
they
allowed
would,
to euthanize
it would
any
be,
pets.
It would be, well, if you brought your pet to a shelter now, or you mean...
Here's what the measure, here's what it says. It says, if the animal shelter acquires the pet from the owner,
okay,
it becomes the property of the shelter, and then, just like you said, it's the same as if it was found on the street or anything else. So, to me, it doesn't matter how they come into possession of it. It's all the same. They can't euthanize anything without following these limited, except in these limited circumstances. I don't know that we need an adjective myself, I guess is my point.
Well, we could just take out homeless and just say from euthanizing pets.
That would seem to solve the problem to me.
I'm fine with that.
The only other things I was interested in, I think, from the motion for rehearing were numbers 1 and 3, the Tabor issues. I think I agree with Mr. Gruskin about if our opinion is this is a tax subject to Tabor, then we should call it a tax and
I think we should say what it is, 15%.
And right, yeah. And okay. I agree.
Those were the only two I was really moved on. I think we discussed the liability and the enforcement issues last time.
Just don't make it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that treaty, that was an issue that we agreed with.
That's
so then on the sales
we agreed with that.
Price, or is it okay as Mr. Ward has?
I think it's more accurate to say, if you're going to include the rate, to say 15% tax on the sale price of pet animals.
Yeah, I think that's good.
All right.
We're using pet maybe there with two different definitions. To address pet overpopulation.
George, if you could stand at the microphone, that would be.
Yeah, I think we might be using pet for two definitions, or I'm not sure. Sell 15% tax on the sale price of all pet animals.
Well, but it's not because we exempt out animals that are adopted from
yeah,
shelters.
That's in the thing.
So, I'm happy with it the way it looks.
Yeah.
All right. Okay.
Then I think I'm happy with it.
Yeah, why don't we collapse it? I'll read it, and then we'll... Shall state taxes be increased $6,275,000 annually in the first fiscal year and by such amounts that are raised thereafter by imposition of a 15% tax on the sale price of pet animals to fund programs and services to address pet overpopulation and in connection therewith amending the Colorado Revised Statutes to prohibit pet animal care facilities from euthanizing pets except in limited circumstances, imposing a monetary penalty for each violation of the euthanasia prohibition, allowing persons to bring court actions to enforce compliance with and penalize violations of the euthanasia provision, and using certain fees and penalties collected to make grants for programs and services to address pet overpopulation. Right.
So then I would move that the remainder of the motion for rehearing be denied except for the changes in the title that you just read.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. That one passes, and we're going to take a 30-minute lunch break and reconvene at 12:30.